Hi, this is Troy Sangra, your host for Korean Context. This week, we talked to Dr. Stephen Haggard of the University of California at San Diego about the North Korean economy and Pyongyang's efforts to engage in economic reform. We'd like to welcome Dr. Stephen Haggard from the University of California, San Diego to Korean Context. Welcome, Dr. Haggard.
My pleasure to be here.
Let's just start off with sort of a look at where North Korea is today. We know that there have been various attempts over time under both Kim Jong-il and recently under Kim Jong-un to take and engage in market-based reforms, but at the same time, there's also been attempts to pull back from those reforms in the past. Where do you see the economy right now in North Korea in terms of being marketized versus the current state system that still maintains some presence within the country?
That's a great question. And I guess I would start by drawing a distinction between the process of marketization and the process of reform. And I think those two things have to be seen as moving along somewhat different tracks. The process of marketization itself actually has its origins in the famine and probably even before, in shortages that households experienced and compensated for by trading and engaging in other market-like activities. And that process has been going on even from the 70s and 80s. I just read an interesting new memoir that's going to be forthcoming that talked about these types of traders existing in the 70s. But the process of reform is different. Those are government efforts. And I would say that over the last 20 years, there have been two large cycles of these sorts of reform efforts. One came in 2002. That was a set of price reforms that were quite extensive, at least in their intent. Very quickly, those were rolled back beginning in 2005, culminating in the 2009 currency reform. And then since that time, I would say that the government has backed off at least somewhat from its attempt to control the markets and so has allowed that process again to flourish. But that hasn't been accompanied by another round of similar government or top-down reform. I've come to believe that there were such reform efforts in 2012, but they ran into barriers, particularly with respect to inflation, and they seem to have slowed.
What types of reforms, if North Korea did want to essentially bring these markets sort of out from the black side and into the forefront and move the economy that way, would they need to do? And I guess along those lines, because, you know, the question is always sort of debated. Is North Korea finally entering economic reform? And you have people who, you know, an announcement we made will say, this is finally that moment. What kinds of things should we really be looking for if North Korea were to make these reforms?
Well, again, let me start by drawing some distinctions. First of all, I don't think that there's any single path to reform. So even if you took two countries that were exactly similarly situated at the outset, there were many ways that those economies could reform in ways that we would see as advancing productivity and efficiency of markets. So I don't want to give the impression that there's a one single cookie cutter path to a market economy. We have varieties of capitalism among the advanced industrial states. There's no reason why we wouldn't have varieties of reform. The second point I want to make is that reform is no one thing, and it can be packaged and taken apart in various ways. These two points I'm making are clearly related. And so there's no one metric. But I would draw a distinction, I think, between reforms that have to do with the management of the domestic economy, and those are the type of things you're talking about with respect to markets, and reforms that deal with the engagement of North Korea with the external sector. And so perhaps we can talk about each of those separately.
In terms of domestic reform in North Korea, one of the things that we had seen, I guess, about a year, year and a half ago, was that state-owned firms would be allowed to now take and have more decision control over their production and other aspects of the firm. So the question, I guess, would be is when we look at the domestic steps North Korea needs to take, are changes on state-owned enterprises giving local managers more control some of the key steps that need to be taken, or are there other areas North Korea needs to look to either in terms of labor market mobility and labor market reforms that they need to do, or do all these things have to go sort of hand in hand?
I don't think they necessarily have to go hand in hand, though I suspect they probably would. The big division is between the industrial, manufacturing, service sector. service sectors in socialist economies tend to be very small compared to the advanced industrial states because retail is not commercialized and so tends to be underdeveloped. The emergence, by the way, of the retail sector, I think, is one important source of labor absorption during the transition process, simply allowing people to set up beauty shops, repair bicycles, do small manufacturing, painters, list your service. All of that is obviously a sector which could grow very rapidly. The big two sectors that would need to be reformed on the domestic side are the agricultural sector and the state-owned enterprise firm sector. In the agricultural sector, again, this could go either more or less quickly. We think generally of some sort of reform of the agricultural cooperative system where greater incentives are given to households with respect to their planting decisions, harvesting decisions, sourcing of inputs. That could take place with the state still procuring a certain portion of the grain at fixed prices, as was the case in the Chinese model. And then allowing farmers to retain the surplus or to farm non-cooperative land. So I think changes in the cooperative structure are important reforms that we keep our eyes on. It looks like some of this was tried in 2012, but one thing that people don't realize is that the cooperatives themselves sustain a fair number of personnel in the cooperative management. And these are people who are basically party officials and administrative officials and probably security personnel as well, who are attached to the cooperative but aren't actually involved in farming activities. So there's a tremendous amount of labor waste within the cooperative structure that's just associated with control and living off the work of the farmers themselves. So streamlining all of that, there are multiple things that could be done from pricing to the design of work teams. If we turn over to the industrial sector, you've hit it exactly right. The first stage reforms of that sort typically involve granting greater discretion to managers with respect to product mix, maybe holding them accountable for profitability, allowing them to move labor, allowing them to fire as well as hire. So there are labor market elements associated with both of these reforms. Again, my sense is that some of this was tried on an experimental basis during 2012. And I believe that one of the reasons those reforms didn't work is because you still had this high inflation aftermath from the currency reform. So it appeared like these pilot projects were associated with rising prices. And then you see the administration backing away from those reforms or not carrying them through in ways that many of us had anticipated, or some of us had anticipated might be the case. So it seems to me that that whole process is stalled, but we can imagine it being picked up again if circumstances were propitious. To me right now, it seems that what the regime has done is to focus much more on the external side and getting foreign direct investment in than undertaking these kinds of structural reforms of the domestic economy, with one exception, and that is it does appear that the government is being somewhat more tolerant of the market activity than we've seen during, for example, the 2005-2008-2009 period, when it seems like there was really a crackdown on the markets.
Let's move to the external side of things. Recently, North Korea announced 6 new special economic zones. And last year, they launched 13 new zones. Have we seen any progress with the original 13 zones? And along the same lines, is North Korea properly utilizing these zones? Or are they missing certain steps they need to be taking to fully utilize them?
Well, if we go all the way back, you recall that the first zone was established in Rajin Sunbong, subsequently Rason, almost 20 years ago. So we have a pretty long history of experimenting with these kind of SEZs over time. The one difference I see is a much more concerted push this time around over the last year and a half or 2 years to think about the SEZ concept as an overarching framework for attracting foreign direct investment. Obviously, the Kaesong example is there for the North Koreans to look at. I think they probably view that, or at least some parts of the government view that as a success in terms of its capability of generating foreign exchange. There have been the island efforts, the two islands that the North Koreans have tried to develop in conjunction with the Chinese. There have been long debates about whether those projects have been successful or not. I noticed that KEI recently ran a very useful piece by Adam Cathcart that discussed the trajectory of those islands. Those don't seem to have come to fruition. And then you have this sequence of first 13 and now an additional six SEZs, which have been planted at various points around the country. My view of this last round of SEZs is that the North Koreans are getting very good advice with respect to the design of the SEZs themselves. And we've had teams go in and look at those SEZs and talk about the management of them. But the broader problem has to do with the complementary commitments on the part of the North Korean government, both to the development of appropriate infrastructure and above all the rules, the institutional ground rules, the protection of property rights, the way the labor markets will work, the opportunities for suppliers, and so on. And of course, free trade movement of people and goods into and out of the zones. So I still think there's a lot of learning to go on, because you have SEZs which appear to be designed well at what might be called the micro level, but no investors have gone in yet. And the reason that those investors are deterred doesn't have to do with the design of the SEZs narrowly conceived, but with the overall policy environment in North Korea.
You had mentioned Kaesong briefly, and North Korea and South Korea over the last year or so have been trying to take and internationalize the complex. At the same time, a lot of the issues you just discussed, be they either labor market or protections for property and things, while there are institutional reforms there, we've also seen the political risk side of it in terms of the complex being shut down. How much damage did North Korea really do to, I guess, one, its reputation in Kaesong, and two, more broadly, by shutting Kaesong down last year? And sort of how can it move forward then to take and really convince international investors that this political risk isn't really there anymore?
I think the shutdown of Kaesong did a tremendous amount of damage. And what's unfortunate is that that damage isn't immediately visible, because the two sides, after a six-month hiatus, were able to reopen the zone with more or less all of the investors there. There was some loss of investment in Kaesong, but more or less all of the investors returned, partly because they had sunk assets in the zone and didn't want to lose them. But I think the knock-on effects for the current SEZ effort are going to be very substantial, because any serious investor is going to look at the track record of the country in question, and the whole question of what happened at Kaesong is going to be on the minds of investors that are contemplating going into the other zones. The difficult feature of reputation, and much investment hinges ultimately on reputation for not reneging, is that it can only be built over time. And so when you take an action such as the Kaesong action, it resonates into the future. And I don't think it's what North Korea puts on paper. It's taking one of the zones and really convincing external investors that it works. And my guess right now is that that role is going to fall on Rosson, that the North Koreans are going to do their best to protect the Rosson effort and to use that as their showcase of what can be done in the other zones.
When we look at Rosson, though, while it's primarily Chinese investment, there's also Russian investment there. And there had been talks earlier, or an agreement, I guess, reached that South Korea would jointly invest with Russia in some of the projects there in terms of the rail line. Given the current situation in the Ukraine and everything, is there the potential for some type of knock-on effect in Rosson from what's going on there and the current level of sanctions or potential sanctions being placed on Russia?
That's a good question, to which I actually don't know the answer, because a lot of it will hinge on what Russia is seeking to transship through Rosson and whether the countries that have been receiving those goods, primarily coal, primarily to China to date, would actually sanction Russia. And in the case of China, of course, that's doubtful. But just to back up a minute with respect to Rosson, Rosson has several possible purposes and uses. One is that it provides a port of outlet for the northeast of China, which it now lacks. There's not access to the sea on that coast. And so having access to a port at Rosson provides a very important transshipment possibility for China, and the same for Russia. So one use of Rosson might just be pure transshipment, And there's nothing wrong with that. That's a legitimate business that North Korea could engage in and could reap some rents from the warehousing and wharfing and transshipment activities they're engaged, would be engaged in that process. But the other hope, I think, is that Rasan would also become a center or hub in a variety of different ways, either as a center for manufacturing for export, the labor intensive type of activities that we saw elsewhere in the Asia Pacific. And more interestingly, which I think hasn't been noted, is Rasan becoming a distribution center for imports from China into the rest of North Korea, where enterprises elsewhere in North Korea would travel to Rasan to conduct business essentially in what would look more like a wholesale market rather than a retail market. So I think it's possible that all those roles may emerge at Rasan in the future. Some of them are going on now. But again, all of these hinge on a combination of reputational factors and the willingness of the North Korean government to allow Rasan to rip, so to speak.
Just to sort of touch on that wholesale idea, is this something that you see to where production in Kaesong and maybe some of the other zones could then be linked into that? And so you start getting interlinkages within the North Korean economy itself, at least on some minimal level by connecting the zones?
Yes, the short answer is yes, that ultimately the objectives and benefits of the special economic zone are not limited just to the labor input. So to step back, the way that SEZs typically evolve is they begin as primarily export processing zones, where virtually all of the inputs are imported, labor transforms those inputs, and then the output is exported. But if we look at the evolution of these zones, ultimately more starts to move across the zone membrane. In addition to labor, you would get some suppliers that would be supplying, and then ultimately maybe even some of the output would be sold into the domestic market. It's important to recognize, though, that the Kaesong model is virtually pure enclave. There are no suppliers to Kaesong, except perhaps something like cleaning services. And very little or none of the products are exported or find their way into the North Korean economy. So the internationalization of Kaesong is not going to change that model. What the internationalization of Kaesong would do is to bring in foreign investors who are not South Korean. And we can talk about some of the barriers to that process if you like. It looks like the new SEZs are aiming for a somewhat different model than the completely enclosed enclave, in which perhaps some of the output would be sold locally, but the SEZ would enjoy certain tax benefits or other benefits, or perhaps there may even be suppliers into these zones. And I think that the North Koreans have been presented a full variety of these sorts of models, and the question now is implementation, not only implementation of the zones, but implementation in terms of actually getting investors to sign up.
Just to touch on your comment then about the challenges of internationalizing Kaesong, we have recently the announcement that there would be this one German supplier who would invest, but it's going to be in a supply office for the South Korean firms rather than actually anything into utilizing really North Korean labor, and it wouldn't be a production facility. The only other international investment I'm aware of in Kaesong was that originally, when it first opened, there was a joint venture, Taesong Hata, to where it was a Japanese partner, and they eventually sold out due to reputational risks. What are some of the challenges that companies do face when they consider whether they should, beyond simply the risks that we talked about on the political side, investing in Kaesong?
This is an example of first mover risk. Any firm that goes in there is immediately have on its shoulders the fact that it's the first mover into Kaesong. So for some firms, they may simply not want to be identified with this kind of experiment altogether. But looking further down the line, if firms do decide to jump in, one of the big issues is how exports from Kaesong would be treated under existing trade agreements. The South Korean position has been, I think, under both governments, past governments, both the Imungbak government, going back to the Nomuhyun government and currently with the Park Geun-hye government, is that exports from Kaesong should be covered under South Korea's free trade agreements, not only with the United States, but a host of free trade agreements that it's signed. It's South Korea has probably signed more trade agreements than bilateral free trade agreements than any other country in the Asia-Pacific region. And so for the purpose of advancing its goals in Kaesong, it would like to see those firms, which remember are South Korean small and medium-sized enterprises, enjoy the benefits of being able to export those products beyond South Korea to the rest of the world. The United States has been very clear on this, or it's been clearly obfuscatory in the sense that it said that it would discuss this at a future point, but it's very clear that that future discussion was designed to yield a negative result. I don't see the United States accepting products that are the output of Kaesong under the CORUS tariff schedule. So that, I think, is going to be an issue, is whether South Korea can convince its trading partners to accept goods from Kaesong under free trade agreement tariff schedules.
One country that is in taking North Korean goods and that actually invests in North Korea is China. And I'd seen recently on your blog that you do with Marcus Solon at the Peterson Institute, Witness to Transformation, you had done some recent work with some of your grad students on looking at Chinese foreign direct investment into China. What can you kind of tell us about the types of investment China is making and sort of where that is right now?
The data is not particularly good. There are two data sets that the Chinese government puts out. I should say, of course, by comparison with North Korea, China is a model of transparency and, in fact, is becoming much better in issuing these kinds of statistics. But there's data from MOFAT, which is basically on the number of projects, and there's data that is on the value of projects or the total amount of foreign direct investment, both in flows and stocks. And so with respect to the composition of the investment, it's pretty diversified, actually. We were somewhat surprised to see that mining projects are there, but there's services, there's tourism, there's manufacturing. There are a host of activities that are encompassed by these projects. The volumes have been going up. The stocks have been going up. Obviously, the size of the investments is very skewed because the mining investments are very large in terms of their dollar or yuan size compared to smaller scale investments. So our guesstimate, though we can't prove it, is that probably somewhere around 75%, if not higher, of the total stock of investment is locked up in large scale investments in the mineral and mining sector, with coal being particularly important at the moment.
Given that China has proceeded with investment, how has China, to our knowledge, managed the risk of investing in North Korea? Or is this merely something that's driven by necessity in terms of developing the local provinces that border North Korea and the need to interconnect them to a larger economic region?
The investment decisions that the Chinese firms are taking appear to be largely commercial in nature. And by that, I mean, even where these enterprises are state-owned enterprises or provincial state-owned enterprises, they don't seem to be receiving central government subsidy. A lot of the firms are, in fact, private, including large private firms that are involved in activities like mining. We forget that the Chinese economy has developed to the point where there are substantial, hefty private sector firms that are involved in activities such as mining. And then you have a whole series of firms which are not involved in investment, but involved in trade in a very small scale, mostly exporting directly. So a variety of enterprises are involved in these activities. All of them have different strategies for protecting themselves. The larger firms that are state-owned enterprises, I think it's more like a mutual hostage situation where the North Korean government is aware of the fact that if it wants to sustain business with Beijing, that it can't go about dispossessing state-owned enterprises. And then in terms of the business models, the risk is mitigated by directly collateralizing the output. So basically, an investment would take place in mining, and the dividends are taken out in the form of exports of ore to the Chinese firm's core production facilities on the Chinese side of the border. There have been some very significant public investment disputes that have taken place where private firms have gone public about the fact that they were believed that they were mistreated, and I have every reason to believe that they were mistreated by competing government authorities in North Korea. But I don't think that this is a case where the Chinese government has been propping up these investments. They're investments where the firms themselves have taken on the risk and figure out ways to mitigate risk.
You've talked about how a lot of the Chinese investment is on commercial terms. And we talked a little bit earlier in terms of Kaesong, where there's a lot of state government guarantees and everything. We have, to a degree, two different approaches here, sort of a state-led approach and a market-led approach. In terms of dealing with the challenges in North Korea, is there an approach that has an advantage? And at the same time, if we're looking to encourage broader reforms in North Korea, which path is perhaps the best to encourage those reforms?
I've been associated with a view that we should try to socialize the North Koreans to approaching market transactions with a market mentality, if you will. The thing that bothers me about the Kaesong model is it's ultimately backstopped and even formally insured by the government. And for curious ways, which I can explain if you like, that insurance proved handy for Park Geun-hye because she could actually threaten to cut off access to Kaesong, effectively to shut it down, and having insurance of those firms made that threat credible. So there was some dynamics with respect to the insurance in that case, which actually redounded to South Korean benefit. But in general, I think that the business environment in Kaesong is basically constructed and imported entirely from the South. And the result of that is that the North Koreans have not really had to study Kaesong in terms of learning what the business environment is like to sustain this type of foreign direct investment. So in some ways, the Chinese model, as you noticed, ironically, is more market-oriented than the South Korean model. And I think there really are benefits to try to separate economics from politics. Recall that this is one of the slogans of the early Kim Dae-jung period. And he meant by that specifically, or one thing he meant by that specifically, was that the government, the South Korean government, would step aside from restricting a private South Korean firms from operating in the North. But at the same time, the implication was that it would also step aside from underwriting the risk of undertaking those transactions. And I think, as with so much of Kim Dae-jung, I think his thinking was really much more sophisticated than people realize on these issues. And he believed that this kind of commercial engagement over the long run, and he always emphasized the long run, would or could have the effect of gradually changing North Korea from below.
In terms of changing North Korea in the long run, the issue that's always sort of sitting in the background is the issue of unification. And much of the discussion has been in terms of the challenges of unification, meaning the costs and how you take and actually reform the economy. And one of, I guess, Kim Dae-jung's insights was this idea of the gradual transformation to try and bring it up to South Korean standards. And I guess you could say we've seen fits and starts with that over the last 15 years or so. But one of the things that President Park Geun-hye has put out, and part of this, I guess, comes from her Dresden address and everything, was this idea that, contrary to the belief that I guess many have had that unification is a burden, is that unification is actually a benefit. And obviously there's political and security reasons why that would be the case. But what do you see as some of the real costs of unification, and at the same time, what some of the real economic benefits would be? So how we should kind of sort of think about this question.
Yeah, this is a, you know, it's a very complex multi-part question. And obviously the circumstances of Germany, Vietnam, and the Korean Peninsula are all very different in terms of what those burdens are. Let me start with the obvious though, which is that the wider the gap in income level between the North and South, the more costly in the short run integration is, because the cost of bringing up living standards, both through investment and through transfers, if those are used, for example, through the way that the exchange rate is managed, which has implications for what real wages are going to be on the two sides of the border, the cost of all of those elements of integration are higher the larger the gap between the two. So there is an underlying economic logic in bringing up incomes in the North in anticipation of unification were it to come. With respect to the benefits, obviously You have a lot of literate and numerate people in North Korea who don't have access to very much capital. And the investment that would flow from south to north under any reunification scenario would be huge, because there'd be tremendous returns to be reaped from tapping into that labor and from tapping into the other resources, think subsoil resources, minerals, and so forth, which are in the north. So now, I think it's wrong to think about that as a cost, because to the extent that these are undertaken as commercial investments, then they obviously yield returns to the holders of that capital as those investments are realized. But of course, all of this has to be nested into the larger human question of how to put a price on the fact that if unification were to come, and I think it's a very low probability event, that it will also involve freeing North Korea from the tyranny which has been for the entire post-war period, and providing, you know, greater mobility and freedom for the people there. So that's very difficult to put a price on. And it's very difficult to put a price on what South Koreans would be willing to pay for that. My own view, again, is, you know, this is a low probability event, but you would probably start with some restraints on labor mobility, if only for security concerns. There would still be a DMZ. There would still be some way in which border crossing would be limited, not only for security reasons, but to control the adjustment costs in the South Korean labor market, and that this would probably be a gradual process. But we really don't know how this would unfold, and you can certainly write scenarios under which South Korea would be called on to take over the management administration of North Korea on very short notice. That's not impossible.
Well, thank you, Dr. Hager, for joining us on Korea Context. I think you've given us a lot to think about in terms of both the long-term future of the Korean Peninsula and the steps that might need to be taken in terms of economic reform, both domestically and towards the international community.
Thanks very much. Thanks very much for the opportunity. I enjoyed it.
Thanks.